This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, am not going to play mini-golf with language again after what language did to that windmill at the 14th hole. In today's episode, we're heading to Aotearoa, New Zealand, to discuss gender identity and sexual orientation. There will be a swear. It feels weird to issue a content note for that when the episode also discusses corporal punishment and colonialism, which are significantly more offensive than an F-word. On with the show.
The British, no, they had a textbook. They had a way they did things. They've refined that in cultures and countries all over the world. And so they just brought that here. And what I'm thankful about is we did retain our culture. We did retain our language. And my belief is that our ancestors hid clues for us to find. A lot of my research, I believe, is detective work to find the clues so that we can unveil what our ancestors thought.
This is Elizabeth Karekere, a Māori scholar and LGBTQ plus activist.
I am chair of Te Whanawhana Trust, and we advocate for takatāpui, that's Māori with diverse genders, sexualities and sex characteristics. This is a Māori term, so it's not for non-Māori. If you're a Māori, you can claim this. This is a Māori identity.
Elizabeth spent years studying this word, takatāpui. An English equivalent might be queer in its current use.
So we use it as an umbrella term, but it's also an identity. People who claim it for themselves to say, actually, I'm all of these things. It's also very useful for people who are in a space of change and in a fluid themselves to not have to pin themselves down. Sometimes the English language can be inelegant and doesn't quite capture who we are. Takatāpui just means we are all of that. We have every potential.
The word takatāpui has been revived since the 1980s.
So it means traditionally intimate partner of the same sex. So we have adapted that today. So we've taken it from our ancestors and helped place us in a clear framework that says our ancestors supported and accepted same-sex relationships, but also in other research we've done, some fluidity around gender and sexuality. And of course, they're very sex positive, which was very offensive to the English.
Takatāpui was listed in the Dictionary of the Māori Language in 1832.
The first Māori dictionary, one of the earliest dictionaries, the definition of that word is an intimate companion of the same sex. But it's a little bit ambiguous as well because the word intimate can be interpreted differently.
Just note that the dictionary was compiled by a missionary named Herbert Williams, so the style erred on the side of coy. A bigger clue came in a manuscript from the 1840s.
By a Māori author, written entirely in Māori, where he tells the story of Henemo and Tūtanekai, who are two ancestors. It's a very famous love story, who would have lived perhaps 400 years prior to him writing the story. And he uses the word takatāpui in there to talk about the relationship between the main male character in the story, Tūtanekai, and his close companion, Tiki, of the same sex, his close companion of the same sex. Takatāpui is the word that's used. And their relationship is very intimate, you can tell, in the words that the author uses.
And takatāpui is an important word because it is linguistic evidence that fluid sexual and gender identities existed in Māori society before New Zealand was colonised, before Christianity was introduced and notions of cisgender heterosexuality were imposed.
So, I mean, that word is the only evidence that in the language that we, those kind of connections existed. My name's Hemi Kelly. I'm a lecturer in the Māori language, which is the indigenous language of New Zealand. I suppose all of my work is related somehow to the teaching and revitalisation of the Māori language.
And the language needed revitalising because although it was the language of Aotearoa, New Zealand, at the start of the 19th century, it was about to face two centuries of attrition.
So take us back a little bit of history timeline. So Captain Cook arrived in 1769. The first European settlers to come here would have followed his voyage.
The Europeans were turning up and introducing such things as potatoes, guns, Christianity, infectious diseases, invasive species, and also the English language. And just as the stoats the English brought with them laid waste to the native bird population, so the English language threatened Māori. And in 1840, the British further asserted themselves with the Treaty of Waitangi, which made New Zealand a British colony, and gave Māori the rights of British subjects whilst retaining their property rights. Supposedly.
The treaty was signed in 1840 between the Crown, the British Crown, and Māori leadership, Māori tribes, with the hope that the Crown would give them some sort of protection, that they would still have full rights and ownership over their own properties and lands. And the British had a different idea about what that treaty meant.
They also had a different treaty, effectively. It was written in both Māori and English, but the meaning of the two versions did not match.
And actually, they didn't even honour that treaty. It was disregarded straight away, and they started to establish law in the country, establish acts that alienated Māori from their lands. There were then the Māori land wars in the 1860s through to 70s and the 80s. If we think about the language, the loss of the language, one thing that I put it down to, there are a lot of things, but in 1867, the Native Schools Act was established, which set up two schooling systems, one for European children and one for Māori children. And the language of instruction in those schools was English, and Māori children coming from only Māori-speaking homes were punished for speaking their mother tongue. And a lot of elders who are still alive today talk about their experiences in those schools. Those schools were operating from 1867 through to 1969. So you can imagine over 100 years of that systematic racism, of oppression of who you are as a person, your culture, being punished for speaking your language, the effects that that had on our attitude towards our language.
What kind of punishments were they given for speaking Māori?
The strap. The strap's the main punishment that I've heard about from elders who talk about their experiences. Yeah, being hit, being whacked, being strapped. But also that being shamed, that might have been worse. Being shamed in front of your peers and also in front of the schoolmasters, as they might have been called back then. Those were some of the punishments. The other thing that we put it down to when we think about the loss of the language was urbanisation, which happened after World War II, the urban drift, where Māori prior to the 1940s were largely living within their tribal communities, rurally, and grandparents and parents and young people were all living in the same home and in the village, and knowledge and all of that was passed down from one generation to the next. And with the urbanisation, people started to move into the cities for work, that was all lost. The breakdown of society as it was, where people now lived individually. So you didn't have that intergenerational transmission of knowledge and language happening. And there was also the social pressure to assimilate and to be white. So that also led to the loss of the language.
When a language has power and privilege, the other languages in that place suffer. To trade with the English, got to speak English. To participate in parliamentary proceedings, got to speak English. It's not a story unique to Aotearoa New Zealand. English didn't become a global language by sitting on the sidelines waiting to be asked to dance.
And my grandmother was a speaker of Māori, a native speaker, but she never passed it on to her children or to me, her grandchildren, because that idea of there being no value in the Māori language was so deeply ingrained in her mind and in the minds of our people at that time, that they refused to teach it or to speak it to their children, because they wanted their children to succeed in an English-speaking world. They wanted their children not to go through the same hardships and troubles that they went through. That attitude has largely shifted now, but that was the attitude just, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And many Māori don't speak Māori, and it doesn't mean we are less Māori. But in knowing my Māori tongue, I have a deeper understanding of why, of who, of how. And so in not knowing or in losing the language or in the language being beaten out of you, you lose not just the language, but you lose that connection to who you are as a person.
Connection to history, to cultural concepts, more than vocabulary, dies with the language. When the language isn't written, as Māori wasn't before colonisation, and people are coerced into not speaking it, it only takes a couple of generations for some things to be forgotten or lost or permanently altered, and for the usurping culture to overwrite the prior one, as if it was never there. Amongst the Māori concepts and traditions that were obliterated was takatāpui.
I'm so convinced that transphobia, biphobia, homophobia is such an integral part of colonization. I reject that as a colonial construct. I reject it as racist. As they took our land, tried to take all of our land, tried to take all of our language and suppress our culture, they also took our expressions of sexuality and gender. And they're as important to us and a core part of our culture, especially because the way that, well, institutional racism, the intergenerational trauma that is the legacy of colonisation has impacted on us and the levels of discrimination against people with diverse gender, sexualities and sex characteristics, that we see that all of this was a massive attempt to cover up what was already there and pretend it never happened.
But some of the evidence that it did happen is inadvertently provided by the Europeans. Documentation reporting settlers or sailors in decidedly non-cishet entanglements with Maori people, and recording their shock that this was not a problem in Maori culture, far from it.
The absence of punishment, because not only do we have the Maori narratives, we have the European record, their own record that said they don't have a problem that people are in same-sex relationships. They don't have a problem that people are engaging in bisexual activity. We don't like this. These are things we have to sort out. And we have that from not only missionaries, but from other sailors, whalers, that it was very clear that they weren't happy about the situation. And so they introduced punishment. They made us illegal. They pathologized us. And all of those things were consciously done. After the treaty was signed, when they did bring more soldiers in and the settlers started swamping our country, then that just starts to flow throughout the whole country. And no, they took over our country in an act of war and many instances of violence.
How did they manage to erase gender fluidity and sexual fluidity and pretend that it had never existed?
So there were some practical things they did. So they punished any fluidity or open signs of sexuality or sex positivity. They made it so it was immoral and dirty and wrong. And for a lot of our people, they rejected that. They ignored it. Didn't matter. But gradually, you wear it down.
What kind of punishments were they using?
Jail was the main one. Because I think we were similar to the English in that, say, someone who was assigned male at birth wearing women's clothes would be arrested for disorderly conduct. And so there were those things that happened. Generally, though, for a long, long time, and even after the treaty was signed in 1840, our communities existed quite separately. Many, many of our people, including my area, were quite distant from major Pākehā settlements because they wanted different things, generally, different spaces. Well, they wanted all the spaces, to be fair.
That's English.
You know, they've got a style. They've got a strategy.
It's never enough space.
never. Never enough resources that they can't take. Yeah, we kind of just got on with it. Our people saw that they had a problem with it, so they just protected their own family, who were Takatāpui, and said, let's not talk about it. And my thinking is that we did that for so long, we've forgotten the reasons. We remember to keep it quiet, we remember to protect, we forget why.
There was no English equivalent for some Maori terms and concepts, so some translations were off. Some were altered by the language being forced into a writing system that couldn't accommodate all of its characteristics. And some things were deliberately not translated, some by the English, but...
A lot of that actually was done by Māori. We did that. And I know that some of it was because they'd embraced Christianity and the homophobia, biphobia and transphobia inherent in that. But actually for others, I think it was still part of them trying to protect it, to say, we're fine with our family who are like this and other people, not a problem, but we know that the colonisers do not like this, the missionaries very much do not like this, therefore we just won't talk about it anymore. And so I believe both those things were operating. But they kept it there anyway. They didn't remove it. And so that says to me, we can't do anything with this in the context we're in. We're trusting that later on, one of you can. That's what I believe.
There's not a lot of literature, really. There's nothing to go on. If there were narratives there's not a lot, if any, that remain that inform us about the nature of those connections pre-European times.
Because if we're oral traditions, we had many different types of songs. And there was one particular type which was derogatory songs where we made fun of people and we hassled other people. There were none of those songs which spoke about fluid sexuality and gender.
There are a couple of stories, and then there are a couple of carvings. There's one carving in particular. We see two male figures embracing. So Christianity swept across the country, and there was not only this bolderization, the sanitization of our language, but also of our art forms. And a lot of our carvings, we have ornately carved houses. Māori were very proud of their meeting houses and would innately carve the outside and the inside, the interior of these houses with figures that represented ancestors. And those carvings have been described as the literature of Māori, the library of Māori, because people could read into them and tell story and talk about those ancestors based on the carving. And a lot of those carvings were very, I suppose, sexually explicit. Perhaps you could see the genitalia, sometimes they were engaged in sexual acts. And remember, this is all telling a story. So there's a story attached to all of these depictions. And so those were also eradicated in a lot of tribes, particularly in the north, where the missionaries set up and had a stronghold in the north, where carvings were eradicated altogether. You don't see any carvings in the north anymore. But some of the tribes that were harder to penetrate are where we see these remnants of what was.
There is some evidence in music.
The example of this that I can think of was an old lament. It was a song to lament the passing of someone. And in the song, the lyrics there say, "Ko te tama I aitia e te rā wahine e te rā tangata." You were the youth who was sexual with that woman and with that man. So this person that they're talking about was obviously sexual with both women and men. In a later edition of some of these songs being republished by a Māori author in the 1920s, you know, after decades and generations of oppression, he changed the word aitia, which means to be sexual, it means to fuck. The youth who had sex with that woman and with that man, he changed that to hug, awhitia, so the man who was hugged by that woman and that man. So it did happen through colonization, starting with the colonizers, and then it was carried on by our own people. Moving into the 60s and 70s, the years where the revitalization of our language and culture started, we started to uncover some of these truths and reclaim some of these words that had been lost.
So one of the things I focused on in my research was around what we call whakatauki. They're kind of like proverbs and sayings, because I love language and I love the succinctness of the whakatauki. So I did my research around over 200 of these whakatauki, anything that talked about relationships, about gender, about sexuality, about sex. So we would commonly use genitals specifically to refer to other things, but we used nature, fire, water to talk about sex. And we had a whole lot of different ways that we talked about relationships and our responsibility inside a family and for your people. Now, it took me quite some time to figure out the language and unpick all of the places where things were purposely not translated. So it was there, right in front of us. I'll talk about two types of imagery that I found in the whakatauki. So the first one was about water, to talk about emotion and feelings inside relationships. And so it's that powerful, that tumultuous kind of feeling that would often be used, but also the calm pools of water. So that would talk about how your partner made you feel and kept you calm and safe. And so there was really beautiful range of water things. Actual sex itself, our people used fire. And many, actually, of the whakatauki, they were very much about a male and female. They're very specific, or they would use metaphors that referenced the receiving and the giving, meaning male and female, and that, you know, heterosexual intercourse kind of way. But what I found in my research is then those extended out. The same imagery that was used in them occurred in other places. So the whakatauki I found, te kōrero ahi ahi ahinewha, that referred to the fires of just women, of women together. So we're talking specifically in that instance about polyamorous sex between women. And so if there's one of those, there must be more of those. All we need to know is that it existed. Our people had a phrase for that, and it has come down through hundreds of years to us.
But if we go back to talking about gender, in Māori it's interesting, there's not a lot of, well, we have the word for him or her or he or she is the same word, so it wasn't important to be very explicit or clear about whether the person was a him or a her traditionally. You understood by context because the word was the same, which is ia. So in eavesdropping or reading just one passage of text, you might not understand whether the person was male or female, but in understanding or hearing the whole context, you would know. So that's interesting, part of our language when we think about gender.
We don't have gendered pronouns. We do have some terms that are male or female specific, but a lot of the gendered stuff that happens is around relationships and construct of family. So with that mother, father, gendered roles, we didn't have those. And that was, of course, something else colonisation brought was the nuclear family. So where we saw is what generation looking after, following generation, suddenly people being pigeonholed, taken away from their community and support bases to have a one man, one woman, married, preferably, with their little children in their house. So we didn't have terms for mother, father. We do have words for sister or brother. We have multiple words for sisters or brothers, but we don't have words for daughter or son. The words we use for them can be used in other contexts. And so those are all words we had to create once the English came.
Hemi Kelly has recently been helping to create new words to expand Māori's queer or rainbow lexicon.
There was a document that came out just recently. It's called Supporting Aotearoa's Rainbow People, and it was a practical guide for mental health professionals working with rainbow people, and Aotearoa's the Māori name for New Zealand. There was about three of us that worked on that document in translating some terms that hadn't yet been translated into Māori. So we sat down with the list of kupu of words like intersex or agender, binary, non-binary, you know, all of these terms that hadn't yet been translated into Māori. We now have words for those words. So it is, we are still in that space of creating words all the time.
How did you go about it? Did you go for a direct translation or something different?
In some places we went for a direct translation. Some words had already been created within the community organically. They just kind of sprung up. And a good example of that is for a trans woman, whakawahine is used in the community. And there was no, you know, official group or body that sat down and said, okay, what's the word for trans woman? You know, that just appeared from within the community.
So whakawahine for our trans women and tangateira tāne for our trans men. And those are very spiritual terms about their spirit and their spirituality being a core part of their identity and who they are, regardless of how they were assigned at birth. And so we also encourage people with the language skills, with the research to find new ways and new terms because different tribes had different terms.
Also, it's kind of the test of time. Like if the Māori-speaking community doesn't like a word, if it doesn't fit, it'll disappear. And so if it's apt, if it's suitable, if it makes sense, it'll be used and it'll last that test of time. And so whakawahine is one that has. It's been around for a while now and it's used. But where we saw words like intersex, we kind of did a literal translation. So you're going back to the English word and etymology, looking at what that means, intersex, and then translating it from there.
Feels like a lot of responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, you have the right group of people working on it and you debate and you put out your idea and that gets contested and you go back and forth. And so there's a lot of thought put into it. And then it's put out there, you know. And if, like I said, if the community use it, it's there to be used. But if not, then perhaps another term will just appear.
I mean, we are geographically small. There's only 5 million of us, but actually our rainbow communities work really closely together. So we actually work really, really hard to ensure that our language is quite consistent. So if I'm writing anything about anything intersex, I'm working with the Intersex Trust. Whatever they say, I will use that language. For our trans and non-binary people, I will use their language. And then they use ours when we're talking about Māori stuff. So that's the key. It's actually a willingness and a mindfulness about language, about respecting each other and where we come from. We create our own language, but the behaviour has been here and the feelings have been here since humans have existed on this planet.
Elizabeth Karakare is an activist and scholar and chair of the Te Whanawhana Trust. Find out more about her work and about Takatāpui at takatāpui.nz. Hemi Kelly is a lecturer in the Māori language and has a podcast called Everyday Māori, which is available in the pod places. You can also find him on Instagram at Everyday Māori and the Facebook group A Māori Phrase A Day. I will also link to Elizabeth and Hemi's work at theillusionist.org/bequest. And coming up in today's mini-illusionist, Hemi talks about the writing systems of Māori. Māori presumably is not meant to be put into a Roman alphabet or that kind of writing system.
Yeah, this is interesting. I was just having this conversation the other day with a friend about creating our own alphabet and what that would look like, because Māori was an oral language. There was no writing pre-European times. There was a lot of artwork and carving and different motifs that were perhaps some sort of orthography or writing, but there was no writing as such. And so when early European arrivals came, they started to, you know, document words, write down words based on their own alphabet. And teaching the language, this is always something I've thought about. It would probably be a lot easier if we had a different alphabet, because the majority of people coming to learn the language are English speakers, native English speakers. And when you pronounce a word and ask them to say it back, they do it with no trouble at all. But when you put a word in front of them that's written with the English alphabet, they immediately revert back to the English pronunciation of those vowels, and they mispronounce the Māori word because the vowel sounds are different. And so I wonder if we did have our own alphabet, how much more successful our language revitalization efforts would be. And is it too late now? You know, like we're in 2020 now. And so all of our literature is written in the alphabet that we have now. And so is it too late to revert to something else or to change the writing system? I'm not sure. We'll leave that up to future generations, maybe.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is auscultation, noun. The action of listening to sounds from the heart, lungs, or other organs with a stethoscope. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Thanks very much to Claire Mabey of The Verb Wellington and to Ian Steadman. Find Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And to hear every episode of the show, read transcripts, find out more information about all the topics and the guests, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, visit theillusionist.org.